socializing. Welcome to Bellwether Friends, definitely not the first podcast featuring a discussion of pop culture and why we think you should like what we like. You should trust us because we're librarians. I'm Anna, and I had to get a new chair because a cat was sitting on my chair.
I'm Aline, and I had ice cream for dessert.
Whoa, outside.
Whoa.
Right? Do the rest of the script.
Oh, every couple of weeks, we will get together and chat about a pop culture topic or two, what we think and how we feel. We'll end the show with our current obsessions. Today we have with us a very special guest.
Today we have with us one of the best friends in the world and a talented writer and artist in her own right, apart from friendship, Kelly Jones. Kelly Jones, yay!
Thank you.
Welcome, Kelly.
Hi.
Kelly wrote Unusual Chickens for the Exceptional Poultry Farmer and the forthcoming Murder, Magic, and What We Wore, which we will be discussing today. Welcome, Kelly. Do you have anything that you want to tell us at the outset?
Not that I can think of.
Excellent. We look forward to discussing chickens and fashion and various other things with you on today's show.
Yes.
Oh, look at me. You were in charge of questions.
Right. Okay. So, when did chickens come out?
It's like the hard questions already. 2015.
Awesome. It came out. Okay. So yeah. 2 years ago. 2 years ago, if you can even believe that. Kelly's debut middle grade novel, Unusual Chickens for the Exceptional Poultry Farmer, was published by Knopf, part of Random House Children's. We were very pleased. We saw it at a conference, and I was photographed with it and tweeted about it because I was so excited to see it. This is a wonderful novel in letters about a young woman named Sophie on a farm where she encounters some magic chickens.
Ex-chickens.
Who have superpowers. And this book has been loved by grown-ups and young people alike. We have a small admirer of the book in our house. How did you come up with the idea of writing about Sophie?
Well, so this is a thing that happens to writers. It's totally normal for us, I hear, not just me, where people show up in your head. And you should not be concerned if this happens to you. It just probably means that you're a writer and you should work on the writing part. But what actually happened first was the chickens. I got my own personal chickens that are real life chickens. They live in my backyard. And because I thought everything they did was fascinating, I would watch them for hours and think about what kinds of superpowers they would like, because it gets boring to just think about what superpower you would like all the time. And so I had a whole list of chickens with superpowers.
As I do,
I thought this was pretty normal.
Super normal.
Yeah, but that turns out not to be a story. It's a really interesting list, but it's not actually a story. And so I was trying to think who would be taking care of these chickens, because, you know, if it was Professor X or something, he would already know what to do. There would not be any issues. And so instead I thought, okay, what if it's somebody who is new to chickens like me? And that's where Sophie came into my head.
So, do your chickens have magic powers?
No, which is a big relief to me. I frankly have all I can handle just with regular chickens. So I don't really know how Sophie does it either, but she's much braver than I am.
So I have seen the magic eggs that your real life chickens produce, and I think that their superpower is producing beautifully colored eggs that taste good. So we're gonna have to like leave that out there.
Yeah, that is true. I've also talked at different times about how gizzards are probably a superpower.
Yes.
Chickens actually eat small rocks, which is what chews up their food, in an organ called a gizzard. And I don't really see how that is not a superpower.
Yeah, I want a spot in my body that does the chewing for me because I get to eat rocks.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome.
I would love to eat very small rocks just in general.
Well,
yeah.
And I like to extrapolate. You know, I often talk to kids about animals and superpowers, and if they have birds that are eating gemstones, which seems to be a thing, then you wonder what happens in the gizzard and if they have to eat even harder gemstones and, you know, like how that all works.
Yeah.
Ooh. Diamond-lined gizzards.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay, so
This is why this is normal for me. Yes.
Okay. Sophie is awesome and cool, and we like her. And if you have not read Unusual Chickens for the Exceptional Poultry Farmer, it is a mouthful, but your bookseller will know about it, because I can surely tell you that I talk about it every time I go in a bookstore, and I'm always telling people they should buy it and read it, which is very fun. And sometimes people do, which is cool.
Yes. Which is structured. Yes.
Very exciting. But you are here today to really talk to us about your forthcoming novel, which is not a middle grade novel, although it is perfectly middle grade appropriate, called Murder, Magic, and What We Wore, which is coming out in September. September 19th, it says.
Yes, that's what I hear.
So this, I just finished reading this, and I loved it, which, of course, should come as no surprise to anyone who listens to the podcast, because I don't read anything that I don't love, because I just don't have the energy. And I had the great good fortune of reading an early version of this that it has come a long way from and through and altered form. But it retains some of the really coolness that I liked about its earlier version. And it's got a whole lot more adventure and a really great cast of characters who are almost entirely female.
Woo!
Thanks for that.
Just tapping that way, yeah.
So, the first and possibly most important thing for our dear listeners is that we have an advance reader's copy of Kelly Jones's Murder, Magic, and What We Wore ready to be sent out to you. So if you tweet at us that you are interested in reading this and DM us at Bellwether Friends, BellwetherFrnds, we will mail this out to you.
Or if you do not tweet, you may send us an email at bellwetherfriendspodcast@gmail.com, and we'll just give it to whoever gets to us first in whatever medium. I suppose you can Facebook message us too.
Yeah, and we'll check the timestamps, even though we don't always check Facebook and our email as frequently as we are on Twitter. But we have this prize for you that we are happy to share, because we have a copy in our house that we have read, and we have another copy. So that's pretty exciting. Tell us a little bit about Murder, Magic, and What We Wore, Kelly. Give me a sort of, like, little overview so I know what you don't consider to be spoilery when I'm talking about it.
Okay. So, Murder, Magic, and What We Wore takes place in 1818 England, which is very different from Sophie's modern-day Northern California farm. And it's about Annis Whitworth, who is recently orphaned, and who discovers that not only did she lose her father, but she lost all of his money, too. This is a problem because Annis is an upper-class young lady, and she doesn't actually have an interest in becoming a governess or a companion. She would much rather be a spy like her father. So she goes to the War Office, and in the process, she discovers that she has a magical talent for sewing glamours, which are a kind of disguise. They can be used in a lot of different things. It's basically a type of sewing magic. And even with this magic, the War Office decides that they are not interested in hiring a young lady and send her packing. So that is where her story begins. And she does not give up. She is not the giving up kind. She still does not want to become a governess. So she goes off to figure out how to convince them that they made an error.
Well, a well-bred young lady could also get married, couldn't she?
She could. And she considers that option seriously, but the timing of that just isn't going to work out. So she decides to choose other options.
Okay. And those options are pretty cool.
Super rad.
Super rad.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So What We Wore is a big deal. It's, you know, the clothes make the man.
Just the man, yes.
But, there's some other cliche. Anna is giving me a look. What's a lady cliche about clothing?
After Labor Day? Or is it before Labor Day?
Don't wear white after Labor Day. Okay, right. So, I found this very engaging and entertaining because Kelly and I have been friends for 15 years. I was thinking about this afternoon as I was preparing for the podcast, and I realized that in early 2002, we were taking a training at our mutual organization of employment, and on the first day of this training that was to take a year, where we would meet every other month, we went around the room, and I was new to the organization, and this is my story, and she's going to correct it as soon as I'm done. So the beginning, everybody went around, and they said what branch they worked at, and so I remember at the first break, Kelly came over to me and said, "Hi, we work at neighboring libraries. Do you live near your library?" And I was like, "Yeah, sort of." And she said, "Great, we can carpool for the rest of the training." And thus was a friendship born. How do you remember it, Kelly?
Well, I thought I had a little bit more of a conversation than that. I thought it wasn't quite as much of a command, but it wouldn't surprise me. And the other thing is, just so you know, that I would never have brought it up if I didn't think that you were reading interesting things and talking about them in interesting ways. And I should clarify also that I used to be a librarian, so this was a librarian training.
Yes, this was a reader's advisory training where librarians read in different genres and discussed yep. things and broadened our scope. And yes. we talk a lot about that stuff on the podcast.
Yes, we had a lot to talk about.
We did.
And I'm not a carpool with just anybody.
This is good to
this
know.
This is good. And this yes. came to, you know, I understood this as our friendship progressed, that this was not, and it was indeed a mutual sort of thing. I believe that my perception comes from not really knowing which libraries were where, because they weren't all, I didn't know my way around the county, and not really knowing it had been such an achievement to get myself to this training that was 25 miles away from where my library was, that I was sort of like, okay, great. I don't know where that is, but I'm okay, sure, whatever. and I mean, I was grateful and it was cool. And of course, we are still friends. And yep. after this training happened and we got to know each other in these drives through rush hour traffic and talking about books, at some point we must have started talking about clothes, because I have in my mind that such a large portion of our friendship has been watching the British What Not to Wear and shopping in thrift stores and revamping our wardrobes.
Yes. I have been told that I have a forceful personality, and I think another piece of that is that I have never been afraid to transform myself in any way.
Awesome. And
yes, and well, sometimes yes, sometimes it makes life a little more challenging, but I decided at one point that I was going to take on style, basically, and that was not something I'd ever really done before, and so yeah, I think you already had style, so that was probably a natural progression of our friendship, yeah.
Hey!
I like a good resource, you know?
Okay.
Wait, you have to... So I have never seen the British What Not to Wear, only the American What Not to Wear, so please illuminate for me
yes.
so, the reason.
Yeah, I didn't really get along with the...
Clinton, Stacey?
American What Not to Wear. But my introduction to the British What Not to Wear was that my partner Eric came home one day and told me that he had heard on NPR a Fresh Air interview with two ladies who told Terry Gross that she could not wear pleated pants. And I had been avoiding pleated pants for some time, and I felt so vindicated that I had to find out more about them. And they are Trini and Susanna. They are amazing. And their basic take on life is that you should find clothes that fit and suit you wherever you are in your life, and that nobody is at a place where they cannot use style in a way that works for them. And it is probably not a coincidence that the book that became Murder, Magic, and What We Wore started around 2005. It started during this time. And
excellent.
It's been a very long time of writing it, but very exciting.
Worthwhile.
I should clarify, because kids always ask this when I talk about this, particularly because some of them were not alive in 2005, that I have not been working on just that book for that many years. I have worked on other things too.
Yes, not yes. least of which is your jewelry
Magical
line,
chickens.
Which I wear when I am speaking a little in bit public. Of
yes. Yes.
Kelly introduced me to Trini and Susanna.
Okay.
Through, I think that Kelly also decided that we were going to go shopping together, maybe.
Probably.
I was very participant and eager and engaged in our friendship. And I swear.
You take no, you know.
And I remember that you either loaned me DVDs or we watched some together, or I don't remember all of it. I mean, I know I ended up watching almost all of them. And the thing about Trini and Susanna was almost the thing about the life-changing magic of tidying up. There were aspects of what they were saying and doing that were applicable whether you agreed with the details or not.
Yes.
And they advocate dressing the beautiful woman that you are. They were almost exclusively focused on women. I think they might have done some dudes a few times.
Yes. But
they were looking at the clothes that you had and the life that you were living, and like the American version, you had this chunk of money and they taught you some things and they sent you out to shop and then they went through what you bought. And watching many episodes of this and seeing many different women was really, really illuminating. And we learned things like you have to try on everything before you buy it. And
yes.
We learned things about dressing the beautiful woman that you are instead of thinking about what you wore when you were in high school or what size your butt used to be or whatever the case may be. And we began to alter our wardrobes. I think we did some thrift shopping first before we threw away everything that we owned. And we started working toward our colors and our styles and our cuts. And now we are women of style.
Yes. Well, and I think the thing that was sort of revolutionary for me about their approach, they never said that you yourself should be a different person than you are. They never said to change yourself in any way, which I know is the same as saying dressing the beautiful woman that you are, but for me that was a new concept. Even though I had never felt particularly inclined to change myself for anything, but the idea that you could do this at any age, any size, any place in life. It didn't matter what you did. It didn't matter who was looking. These were all kind of new for me. And the other thing that I think was really key for me was that I was in my 30s at this point, and I was interested in dressing for me, not for anybody else. Mm-hmm. And that was something that they did. They were very clear about. They were not suggesting that you dress in a way for anybody else's vision of who you were other than yourself. And that was very appealing to me.
Yeah. I like it. I mean, I still use it now. Yeah. I was putting myself together for a particular thing today. And I was thinking about this where over the years, Kelly and I worked toward having things in our closets and our dressers that we could just pull out and put on and know that we looked good and not have to worry about whether they went together or whether they fit right or whether they hung right or if we had a full-length mirror that we could check the back of, because we had already done all of that with it at some point in the procurement process. And so yes. I didn't have to think about, I thought about the outfit that I was putting together today, but I got up this morning and I took a shower and I put it on and I wasn't like worried, I wasn't concerned, I wasn't thinking, is this just right or not? I don't, and maybe everyone has already gotten past that in their lives, but I know a lot of people who are still like, about what they're going to put on and whether they have something for a special occasion. Like, I could be invited to a cocktail party tomorrow night and I would be prepared to go because I have the spangly dress and I have this and I have, you know, the accessories and the undergarments that I would need to put this together. And I can do it from like cargo shorts and a hoodie all the way to a cocktail dress and heels, and I'm good.
Yes. And I think, you know, that's something that a lot of writers, frankly, really struggle with, because we go from writing in our houses in our sweatpants to a lot of public presentation. I don't think I've ever had my photo taken as many times in my life as when my debut book came out.
Woohoo!
which was awesome. But I was really glad that I had some clothes that I felt comfortable in, that I knew weren't going to have any issues.
Yeah.
That was really a nice thing to have in my back pocket at that point, because that's not, it's not something I would have wanted to figure out on the fly at that moment.
Right. And we've all met someone who was like, oh my gosh, I have this work dinner that I have to do this for, so I have to go out and buy something this afternoon, or I'm going to be messed up. And you've all, you've heard that story, or you've read it in a novel, or you've seen it on TV or in a movie, and mostly that just starts making my chest hurt because I can't take the anxiety of it. And so putting that all aside, I don't have to worry about what I'm going to get up in the morning and wear. I mean, I do have to decide between a pretty big collection of just about everything. But almost all of it looks great on me.
It does.
It's true.
How about you, Anna?
What about me?
Do you like to dress the beautiful woman that you are?
Yes.
Excellent.
And often in a quite mannish way.
That developing your style and finding what works for you is also part of this process.
It took me a while. And for many years of my life, when I was still at home, I enjoyed shopping with my mother. And I would act as her style advisor. But I wouldn't particularly apply anything to myself. It was like a sweatpants or... I eventually got a pair of jeans. Very exciting. And, you know, t-shirts and so on. And going thrift shopping with Eileen is always an experience. I endorse wholeheartedly. And we pull off whatever we feel like we need to try on, and then we try it on, and we usually end up with a few excellent items. We are also shopping for little G, who is not always with us, so we have to keep that in mind, things that he might like.
Yes. I grew up not really thinking about my physical appearance as much. You know, I had some various times when I focused on various things, but it was never like a big piece of my life. I was more focused on other aspects of my life. And so it was really interesting to think about how I wanted to do this, because I didn't want to follow any of the traditional style or fashion or trend or, you know, and none of that particularly mattered to me and still pretty much doesn't. So thinking about what my version of that was going to be was really key for me.
I have this vivid memory of us at... Right, let's see if it's reality.
Eileen's version.
You can tell me if you remember it or not. We were at the Dearborn Goodwill. And we had a shopping cart piled with what must have been, I know that I tried on more than 30 pairs of jeans. And so maybe we had the shopping cart piled with 60 pairs of jeans, or maybe only 50 or 40. But I remember commandeering a dressing room and trying on every conceivable pair of jeans in our size range and finding things that fit and looked good. And we would do this routinely. We would do it at Value Village. We would do it with jeans. We would do it with trousers. We would do it with shirts and sweaters. And we would spend hours. Like, we would be at any given store for 3 hours and try on an enormous cart of things. And sometimes we would walk out with a giant bag full of clothes. And sometimes we would walk out with, like, two items. And it was... And it's still like that. I still try on 10 pairs of pants for every one pair I find. I think that that is like a hobby or some, it's not something that everyone is interested in doing or that has the patience for.
I mean, it's basically applying the research process to clothes, right?
Okay.
I mean, you don't just start with one source and believe it, right? You don't believe that that's the only thing possible.
Right.
I mean, and if you cannot try on a bunch of ideas and evaluate them to the best of your ability, then how confident are you going to feel in your choices?
This is a very good point.
I, at least at that point, was not that confident. I could not have done it with five easily and felt like I knew that this was the best that I could do with myself at that point, you know?
Right. And we, you know, we we built our skills. We got to where we yes. knew what our approximate size was and what brands right. came in a short length for our petite statures and,
right.
you know, what how we wanted to be wearing dark jeans. And so we would just skip over the stonewashed things and so
right.
on.
Right.
Yeah, it was definitely, it was a process. And it was, but it was the thing that we did. It was the thing that we did together, and we had a lot of fun doing it. And I mean, Anna, I have indoctrinated Anna into the process. I go shopping by myself, but she joins me too, and we find her awesome clothes.
Yes, so we went on an Argyle spree recently.
Oh, nice.
Where in a variety of shopping expeditions, we found mm-hmm. 5 or 6 sweaters, some cardigans, some solid. And
yes.
some, 1 or 2 vests, I think. And I already had a couple of vests.
Yeah.
Enough for me to have 8 different Argyle outfits.
Right. Argyle week went a day over.
That's true. And oh. I think we acquired a few more things after Argyle week was over.
True. I like dressing other people, too.
Yes.
I mean, Kelly,
the part that I always remember about our expeditions is that we did not just advise each other. We would also let any random person in the thrift store know if they looked particularly good in something.
Yes,
they would immediately ask our advice on everything else they were wearing.
Yep.
Which, and the piece that I always remember about that is how everything from their posture, you know, their entire way of being changed in that moment, going from not being sure to being like, okay, this is right, this is good, this is, I'm feeling it, I'm okay, I made a decision. And that's really awesome.
Yeah. And we were more believable than a salesperson in a department store, because we have
right.
no horse in the game. And
right.
we were less scary because we were more focused on each other, you know.
Yeah, and that's completely unsolicited, so yes.
Yeah.
This would be why I have a forceful personality, but yeah. I use it for good.
Yes, you do, and I do it too when I am walking by someone who is, like, standing, posing in front of the mirror at Value Village. Mm-hmm. I tell them they should put it on, or I tell them, yes, that's a great color on you, or, you know, and I just say things in passing, and I don't, like, stop and engage in a conversation with them. I just sort
right.
of am like, yeah, you should totally go with that.
Yes.
So I knew that I wanted to talk about fashion. I forgot to say that up front, that we had this great author on, and then we were going to talk about our personal fashion paths. But there you are. That's the beauty of Bellwether Friends.
Oh.
So we have often watched and read and seen. Sorry, watching TV and watching movies are different things.
Okay, one is watching and
one
is
watching
seeing.
And one is seeing.
Okay.
Or for the purposes of this conversation. And I wanted to find out from all of us, and Anna can start, with our movies or TV or books where the fashion was a character or part of the setting or something for you.
So I have a couple, and one is the similar, like the Regency setting. So I read all the Georgette Heyers that I could find and all the Patricia Varians, and then, you know, the ones that are set now, the fashion doesn't strike me as much for whatever reason, like Sarah McLean or whatever. Doesn't call my attention as much.
There's not as much description of it, I don't think.
I have a little passage from Regency Buck.
Oh, you have a dramatic reading.
I have
for
a dramatic
us.
Reading.
Thank you.
From Regency Buck, which is by Georgette and was published in this edition, which I think was my mother's, 1967.
Excellent.
He was the epitome of a man of fashion. His beaver hat was set over black locks, carefully brushed into a semblance of disorder. His cravat of starched muslin supported his chin in a series of beautiful folds. His driving coat of drab cloth bore no less than 15 capes and a double row of silver buttons. Miss Taverner had to own him a very handsome creature, but found no difficulty in detesting the whole cast of his countenance.
That's awesome.
Yes. Georgette was really good with men's fashion, which happens less often. And yes, you can actually predict how a man's character will be depending on how he is dressed and, you know, how he'll behave and everything in difficult situations. And it is not necessarily what you would expect as through modern societal lenses, so to speak.
Excellent. I do love the phrase many-caped greatcoat.
Yes.
I have longed for a many-caped greatcoat.
15, though? 15?
15 seems a little excessive, but that, many-caped.
Yeah. Plus not an even number.
Do you have more for us?
I do. So the other one I have is one that has always stuck with me. It is from Tipping the Velvet, a seminal work of historical lesbian fiction by Sarah Waters.
I love historical lesbians.
And present-day ones as well.
Yes.
So, toward the end of the book, the main character, whose name is Nan, has been through a series of changes in her life. And she is been down and out, and she is working in this household. And she's kind of got a thing for the lady that lives there. And so, one day, she goes out and buys some men's clothes and gets her hair chopped off. And she buys a pair of moleskin trousers and a set of drawers and a shirt and a pair of braces and some lace-up boots. And then, this is going to take a little while to read.
Okay.
But I can see that you're
going to... I'm ready.
Okay. She didn't seem in my moleskins either, for I had promised myself that, for the sake of the neighbors, I would only wear them to do the housework in. And by the time she came home from Stratford each night, I had changed back into my frock and put an apron on. But then, one day, she came home early. She came home the back way, through the yard, behind the kitchen, and I was at the window, cleaning the glass. It was a large window, divided into panes. I had covered the panes with polish and was wiping them clear, one by one. I was dressed in the moleskin bags and the shirt. I had left the collar off. My sleeves were rolled up above my elbows, and my arms were dusty, and my fingernails black. My throat was damp at the hollow, and my top lip wet. I had paused to wipe it. My hair I had combed flat, but it had shaken itself loose. There was a long front lock which kept tumbling into my eyes, so that I had to push out my lip to blow it back or swipe at it with my wrist. I had cleaned all the panes except the one before my face, and when I wiped at this, I jumped, for Florence was standing on the other side of it, very still. She was clad in her coat and hat and had her satchel over her arm, but she was gazing at me as if, well, I had had too many admiring glances come my way in the years since I had first walked before Kitty Butler in a party gown and not known why it was. She flushed to look at me, not to know why it was that Florence, studying me in my moleskins and my crop, flushed now.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, that book is really good on clothes, too. Like, and the cover, too, like, you can tell by the clothes so much about that book. It's amazing.
It's a good book, and it's been in the... there was a BBC?
Yep, there's a BBC adaptation of it.
Yeah, yep. So that's good. Kelly, talk to me about... Wait, do you only have books, Anna, or do you have movies and TV?
Well, let's do books first.
Okay, we'll do books. Kelly, do you have books?
Ooh, so this was really interesting, because I have been thinking really hard. I have read a lot of fantasy in my life, and I can think of very few clothing things that come out to me from fantasy books, which is fascinating to me, because if you have ever worn any of the things that the people in these books are wearing, it is a process. Like, it is more of a process than getting ready for a ball to put on a suit of armor, right?
Right.
So why? Yeah. Like, why do we talk more about Regency men blacking their boots than, like, armor care? Like, I know that people had people to take care of these things, but it's very interesting to me. So Ellen Kushner's books always have amazing clothes.
So did Ellen Kushner write Swords Point?
Swords Point, The Privilege of the Sword, yes. Thomas the Rhymer, yeah. There have been, you know, obviously Stephanie Burgess is great with clothes.
Yay!
There have been others, certainly, but not nearly as many as I would think, and I find that really interesting. And then, of course, Caroline Stevemer and Patricia Reedy's Sorcerer and Cecilia books. But yeah, when you think about, like, how complex some of the costuming is, not costuming when you're wearing it every day, but that is really interesting to me, that I can't think of more clothing examples. And part of that, too, is that I tend to be interested in clothing details when they point out that somebody... So clothing is a major form of characterization, in my opinion. Like, what somebody wears. The example that Anna read was perfect. Like, that, her choosing to put on that outfit at that time for that reason says everything. And I feel like in fantasy, it's a little bit more of a role than an individual characterization sometimes.
Okay.
Like, you're just expected to wear the whatever you're wearing. It's kind of a missed opportunity now that I think about it.
I'm thinking about fantasy now too. So
yeah, prove me wrong.
No, Brandon Sanderson's series of Doorstoppers, the new one. The women of a certain class have to hide one of their hands in their clothing. Okay. It's called their safe hand, and they have to keep it hidden. And so that's like a weird costuming choice that informs like the way that they move around in the world, which
But that's kind of like a role thing.
Handmaid's Tale
by Margaret Atwood would be another example of that. There's a very prescribed form of dress.
Yeah.
And when people go outside of that, it's a choice, but it's a choice of role more than a choice of individuality.
Huh. Yeah, so I haven't come up with anything.
Yeah, whereas notable. In romance, it's a huge part of characterization.
Definitely. I mean, modern, too.
It is, though, you still, like Anna was saying, you don't get as much in a 21st century written Regency romance as you get in Georgette Hare, for example.
But I'm thinking of, like Jennifer Cruzzi's shoes in Bet Me.
Yes, okay. Yep.
Or, I mean, if you go into the erotic romance category, there's often a lot of that weird name dropping stuff where like she was wearing designer the Prada clothing. Shoes and the whatever, but that doesn't have the same kind of texture or characterization that Georgette has, because it's sort of just like, we're just going to drop this name now,
and it just means expensive. Or it doesn't evoke an actual fabric or feel.
In Beautiful Bastard, which we've talked about before on this podcast, he has a thing about, like, keeping her underwear, and they meet in an underwear store again when she's, like, trying to restock. And it's sort of very specific to their vibe, so that is one that I can think of, but...
Hmm. Okay. And even Georgette, like, Georgette was... She did name specific names with men's clothes, different things. There were certain tailors and bootmakers that she would name drop, and she basically, you know, she categorizes a person and sort of their social set with clothes, particularly for men.
Yeah.
But it does have more texture, I would say, at least through my eyes.
Book-wise for me, I came to Regency romance as an adolescent, and the first one that I read might not even be considered a romance, but it was The Scarlet Pimpernel. I've talked about it on the podcast before. And it has descriptions of dress. The Scarlet Pimpernel is a dandy who is also a spy. And the descriptions of what he's wearing when he is in his dandified mode rival Georgette's in the description of his face powder and his patches and his wigs and his lavender lace falling from his cuffs. And I was searching on the internet to try to find a passage to read, and I was unable to do so. And we don't have a copy of the book in the house, but these descriptions are still vivid in my mind 32 some odd years after first reading it. And I never reread it. I just remember this stuff. So I think that that was a really big deal. And it was, he was a dandy, and then sometimes he would like pull off the lace and go swashbuckling through the night. And sometimes he was just sneaking around at a ball where he was all fancily dressed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have read similarly evocative descriptions in Georgette Hare, and less so in, you know, Amanda Quick in the 90s, and then Sarah McLean and Julia Quinn, you know, in the 2000s. But that one really, really stands out for me. And I still recommend it to people.
Yeah, as I'm thinking about it, too, the thing that I think of in middle grade books in particular is that what usually stands out is what a character does not have and wishes they had.
Mm. Oh, yes.
The fashion, like, that's a big thing. The example that came to mind was Noel Streatfeild. I think it was ballet shoes. This is a older classic, but this type of thing still happens. I think it's a current trope as well. These sisters have to go to ballet class every day, and they're the only ones with the cardboard box with their stuff in it instead of the nice leather satchel.
Right.
That points out what kind of person you are, or what kind of person you feel like you are.
Yeah, having the having a disparity among characters and the longing or the covetousness is
that's what comes out in the middle grade.
Yeah,
I mean that's how you see it on the page in middle grade. I think
something that I this relating to our last episode, something that I notice when I'm reading a new-ish book in a variety of genres that are set in our world is Chuck Taylor's are name dropped. Frequently.
That's probably why we wear them, is because we've been reminded of them in our reading.
Right,
our movie
right. That's probably it. That's probably yes. it.
And they're very cool.
The one that comes to mind for me with those, yeah.
So, do you have TV and movies, Anna, that are fashion heavy for you?
So, I was looking at a variety of lists, and I watched Project Runway for a long time, which is, I think, a different animal than a TV show where people are wearing different things in the course of being characters. So we can put that aside for now.
Right, but you know, but Project Runway does a thing for its watchers. You know, it's looking at fashion as a thing rather than just something that happens. It's looking at fashion as something that is created
yes.
and is that people are active participants in, which is something that Kelly and I endorse. I have only seen a little bit of Project Runway.
The major failing of Project Runway on that front is that whenever they are forced to dress normal people, such as the contestants' mothers or some other mothers or normal women, they are like, oh, I can't even, these bodies. It's
too much flesh here.
Yeah,
oh
right.
my God.
Yes. They cannot handle it.
So I have been watching in one of my other worlds. I spend a lot of time talking to people in museums, and everybody seems to agree that fashion is being treated as an art more and more, and that's a relatively new thing. For a while there, you saw fashion from long ago treated as art. You saw armor before that even, which is an interesting thing to think about. But now you're currently, you know, there's Iris van Herpen, who's a designer in her 30s, who's currently working, just had her first major exhibition, and it's being treated as art. It's not being treated as something that you wear necessarily, which I find really, really interesting, particularly because although many of the designers have been men for a long time, it's currently seen more as part of the women's world. And so I find that very interesting that that's getting more recognition as an art form as opposed to something that people just wear.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. When I think about fashion, I mostly think unwearable. And
right.
I think that building art on a human form is definitely art and can be done. But when I think about couture and Fashion Week and things that you see from a fashion with a capital F standpoint, I mostly don't think of it as applicable to life. And
right. Any more than I would put most paintings in a museum in my house.
Right, right. So that's interesting.
I'm not saying that I necessarily love how separate those things are at this point, but it's an interesting way for me to be looking at it.
Right, yeah.
So Project Runway is good for that aspect of
it's good. And sorry, I didn't mean to digress too much.
No, digression is fine.
I want to hear
so as for
your...
a show that I watch where I notice what people are wearing, I used to do that with Buffy. I did it with the Gilmore Girls. I would always like be like, what is Lorelai wearing now? That's interesting.
With the pink t-shirt and the cutoffs and the cowboy boots.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, starting out there and moving on. Another show that came up was Ugly Betty. I used to watch that once upon a time, and that was interesting because it was set in the fashion magazine world, and so there was consciousness among the characters as well as people just wearing their costumes. But I tend to always watch what people are wearing on a show. Sometimes to the exclusion of paying attention to what's happening on the show.
What about movies?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Kelly TV. Do you have TV?
Oh, yes, I do. Definitely Miss Fisher's Mysteries.
Yay!
Yes, love 20s fashion. Can't wear it at all. I mean, for me, that's a completely unwearable style, but I love it. House of Elliot was amazing.
Yes! For fashion.
And that was not only amazing to watch the fashions, but it's about two sisters who found their own fashion house. And so the discussion of that is fascinating to me. I also, are we doing movies too?
Go for it.
Okay. One area of, so talked about fantasy, but one thing that is incredibly vivid for me is the Incredibles scene where they're picking costumes.
I love that one.
And that character. So superheroes is another really interesting thing where costuming is seen as a critical choice for a whole variety of things. And if you follow any of the fandoms at all with comics, like, is this person going to wear this outfit for men and women is a huge question.
Yes, Wonder Woman in pants.
Right.
Or what not.
What will Marvel's hair look like? Yes. But also for men, will Luke Cage wear the yellow t-shirt or not? Is he going to wear his headband thing or not? These are like huge issues for people, which I find really interesting.
That is interesting.
Because actually, yeah, I have to say, like, spandex less protective than armor, so why it gets like more, it is interesting. Very interesting.
I read the Forgotten Realms series of fantasy books, and there was a cover in which this busty woman had chainmail on, but it was chainmail that, like, exposed a teardrop in the middle of her chest.
Right.
Well, that's where you stick the sword.
Well, yes, but so in the book there was this description of how that's actually how it looked, but there was, like, a magical protection there, and there was a reason for it, and I was like, I don't think so.
Yeah, the conversations around what the impact of blades would do or any sort of weaponry on boob armor, you know, the traditional, like, cup style.
Right.
Boob armor. Yeah, very interesting. But just, you know, also just how complicated. I guess superheroes, they have to be able to get in and out of things quickly if they have secret identities. So that does make sense to me. Like, costuming. So I used to do musical theater in high school, and, like, how quickly you can get in and out of something is a big deal.
Yeah.
So
yes.
It makes sense. It makes sense. Like, you would be paying more attention to your clothes. But, yeah, really interesting.
I think it's interesting that Supergirl is always, like, pulling her shirt open and going off to help people, but then she somehow has this long, fluttery skirt on under her capri pants.
Right.
You know,
right.
She's got her outfit on
she
under
has
her
superpowers.
Clothes, but she wears right. these, like, very, you know, very trim, little, you know, young admin in a business office kind of outfits, and somehow her outfit's under that. Anyway.
And not to mention the Hulk's pants.
Oh, like, yes.
Had the mystery of the Hulk's pants.
They refuse themselves.
You know, somebody really should get the properties of that fabric down, because I could use that some days, you know?
Yeah. But do you have other TV?
I think I'm done.
So my TVs are, interestingly, historical costume dramas that, like, The Tudors and The Borgias and The Crown and Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about, I like Game of Thrones because it has, like, some ancient Rome action, because there's the brothels with the ladies all, like, scantily draped, and then there's the armor, and there are sort of medieval gowning for some of the ladies, and it's all over the place. I liked the Borgias because Jeremy Irons is very papal, and everything is jewel encrusted and heavily brocaded. And in a contemporary made television drama, I can just admire the fabrics, and I'm not thinking about how infrequently they were laundered, as I sometimes do when I'm reading.
Right.
And the one that came to my mind as we were talking, when Anna mentioned Buffy, I was like, oh, Sex and the City. The
yes.
things that those women were wearing in New York at that interval, it's this sort of, like, slice of what you can see. And there is absolutely nothing on any of those women that you would see a human wearing. They were very much like catwalk fashions. And they were really interesting to see and fun to watch. And I did not see that in some of the other ongoing things. I never paid any attention to what anybody was wearing on Friends or How I Met Your Mother or any other sort of thing that I would consider to be kind of my era or milieu. And I'm way more interested in costume drama. Miss Fisher is way up on my list.
Oh, Miss Fisher. You know what? I spend a lot of time watching The Mentalist just because I like the three-piece suit that The Mentalist is always sporting.
Okay.
A variety of three-piece suits.
No, and I can see that, liking some particular choices. And I liked what Scully was wearing on The X-Files back in the 90s.
Yep.
We watch The X-Files now, and I am not very compelled by her her frumpy suits, but I loved them back
then.
They get
less frumpy as the years go on.
They do, a
little
bit.
But she gets pointier and...
She does. So, do you have movies?
I do have a few movies. I saw this on a list, and I was like, yes, Clueless, which, so we listened to this oral history of Clueless, and they talked about the fashion, and I thought it's very of its time, and it influenced fashion, according to the oral history.
Yeah.
It influenced fashion. And so when you watch it, you're like, wow, that plaid ensemble is something to behold.
Well, yeah, and anything that's a remake of Emma has to have fashion as a character, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
They did
yeah.
such a great job. And then the one that came to mind before I even Googled anything was Charade, because Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant, so...
Yeah.
And she was dressed, you know, there's a lot of talk about how Yves Saint Laurent did her clothes and things, but I believe that she was dressed by Adrian in Charade, and that...
Let me check.
I think that was one of the first ones where she did a contract where they had to do all of her costuming. Yeah, but I think she had done some films first.
And there was a lot of that. There was, who is that woman with the black glasses who was...
Edith Head.
Thank you. Thank you. I knew that somebody was going to know. But there, all of these fashions...
Edith Head
who was
did
based
all
on her?
The one in Incredibles.
Yes.
Yes.
Edith Head did Hepburn in Sabrina.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Funny Face.
But who did
looking
Charade?
I'm scrolling down the list.
It's not Adrian? Oh, Givenchy. Who did Adrian?
I don't know.
Huh. Well, but everything is super cohesive.
Yes.
And so
the unified.
Very unified.
Whole.
Charade was on my list, too. Do you have other movies?
I just like a costume movie, so for some reason I thought of Shakespeare in Love as the, like, just the...
Yeah.
The...
It was pretty.
Sort of interpretive Elizabethan costume.
Yeah.
With a sort of, like, a looser, modern vibe here and there.
And for some reason, saying Shakespeare in Love, you saying Shakespeare in Love made me think of Titanic, and I don't know why. And then that made me leap to A Gilded Age New York and think of Age of Innocence.
Oh, yeah.
Which was really beautifully done. Do you have movies, Kelly?
The Incredibles, I think, was my main one. I mean, most superhero movies, costuming is a big part, again. But it tends, I wouldn't say it's a character. I would say it's a characterization.
I was thinking about, I think it was the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man,
yeah.
where he,
yeah.
like, makes himself a spider costume out of his pajamas and then goes to the wrestling ring in his pajama costume.
How to Get the Clothes is always very interesting, too, both for, like, superhero-type movies and for these sort of, I get, maybe it is that middle grade thing again of, like, this is the thing I don't have. I don't know. There's something about the acquiring of clothes that's very interesting.
My movie is Desperately Seeking Susan.
Oh, yes.
Which was a time and a place that had an impact. And I mean, Madonna's reinvented herself a million times, but boy, that early Madonna.
Yeah, she always signals with clothes.
Yep, she does. So
yeah.
That's an interesting sort of fashion thing. I have covered the things on the list, on my list, that I wanted to talk about. Do you have anything on your questions, Anna, that you wanted us to cover?
I wanted to
mention
that we just remembered that Loretta Chase has a series called the Dressmaker series.
Oh, yes.
Set in the 1830s, where these French sisters have come to London and is determined to conquer the dressmaking trade. And they've got imagination, wile, guile, and audacity to succeed.
Nice.
We recommend that series very highly, along with all of the rest of Loretta Chase.
We love Loretta Chase.
And especially the audio versions read by Kate Redding.
Yes. Kate Redding did Lord of Scoundrels, which is the A+ number one historical romance of all time in many people's estimation. But this Dressmaker series that Loretta Chase wrote has run to 4 books so far. And they are delightful because these women, they are part of a family in France that was in disgrace because an aristocrat married a woman who was not of their class and then had these daughters, and then they've come to England. So they are dressmakers, they are shopkeepers, they are part of the merchant class, and of course they all end up with dukes and right. whatever.
It says they're short on scruples.
Are they short on scruples? Does it say says. That?
Yes.
Excellent. They end up in, they're romance novels. They're wonderful. I think that we have talked about the things that I wanted to talk about. I was looking back at Murder Magic and what we wore and thinking about clothes, and I wanted to say that if you are a reader who thinks, oh my goodness, yes, I want to read a book that is set in 1818 in London because that is an era that I adore, it is entirely possible that you, having read many other things, will find friends among its pages.
Yes.
Yes. That was the most fun ever, was figuring out who would be in London society at that time and what they would be doing, and in some cases, pulling in real people who had no say in the matter being long dead, and in other cases, asking other people for permission to borrow their characters for a moment or two. That was so much fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We had Stephanie Burgess on the podcast a few episodes ago, and she was delighted to have heard from you about her characters being in your book. So that's really wonderful.
Complicated because it mattered to me to get the year right, and so I had to figure out what everybody would be doing in that year.
Yes, yes. This is so important.
You're going to have to look a little bit harder at some of the names because they might not be the same as in when.
Luckily, there's a handy guide.
And thanks for that.
So check the back of your book if you're like, wait a minute.
Yes.
In September.
Yes. It was really fun, though. The bummer with that was that there were so many Regencies that I loved, and other books set in that those particular years that weren't either middle grade or young adult. This book is published as young adult, and so I didn't pull in all of the adult ones because some of them might not have been appropriate for that readership.
Might not have been a good fit for the family.
Yes, and also I could have, gone into the hundreds of books, and that would have been too many people.
Yes, that would have expanded it a lot.
It would have been, but there were so many, and so I have to... Have you guys read Sorcerer to the Crown?
Yes. Either of you?
Anna has.
Oh my god, I love that book. And, the Temeraire books, that I could not just put in Temeraire with the... Yeah.
Which is too bad. That was my obsession last week because we were reading it for our roundtable. Although Aline has now said that she's not going to read anymore.
She told me something sad happened. So anyway,
I can spoil you exactly on what every sad thing happens if you would like. I appreciate that myself as a reader, and so yes, we can go over that later.
Maybe we'll have to do that, and that might help me, because when Anna told me, I was like, okay, I don't want to read that, and then I was like, well, knowing that it happens makes it a little easier for me as a reader, so maybe we'll have a Temeraire discussion sometime in the future.
I read the end first.
Yes. Do you, Kelly, have a musical obsession?
I do. I have been obsessively watching Teen Titans, which I never watched when it was on. I hear that it is not on the TV anymore.
It is, I think. I mean, it comes up frequently on Cartoon Network, I think.
It has a theme song. I've never been a regular TV watcher on the actual TV, so that is hard for me. But it has a theme song that is sometimes done in English and sometimes done in Japanese by Puffy AmiYumi.
Oh, yeah, AmiYumi!
Yes. It's very wonderful. I really like it and have it stuck in my head really a lot. And there's apparently going to be a karaoke episode, which I'm really looking forward to, where they do the theme song.
Okay.
That they do the actual words of the Japanese translation, and I'm very fascinated by that because the English version of the theme song and the Japanese version do not have the same meaning.
Ah.
Yeah, and so it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it. But yeah, that's pretty much in my head all the time because I'm totally obsessed with team-ups. And so Teen Titans is very good for me.
Yeah, they're not, makes sense.
There are not that many funny team-ups, and that's a good one.
This is a good segue for me because my musical obsession is the opening number for Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, yes. That's really good.
Which is called Tank.
Yes. Exclamation point. The music in that. Oh, my God.
I was playing it for Little G, so I don't know if you heard it from the other room.
I didn't hear it, but I loved Cowboy Bebop, and I'm sure I'll recognize it, but I'm not able to conjure it in my head right now.
It's the closest I can come to jazz, Cowboy Bebop.
Great. But we'll put it on the Musical Obsessions playlist. So my musical obsession is a bit of a tragedy right now because Anna listens to the podcast Extra Hot Great, and they do interesting quizzes, and sometimes they are, maybe they're all musical, I don't really know because I don't listen to the podcast all the time, but recently she played one of their quizzes for me that was a name that tune with 1 second of TV theme songs, and it was very entertaining, and there were a lot of TV theme songs that got stuck in our head as a result of listening to the quiz, and the one
not the Gary Shandling Show, is it?
It's not the Gary Shandling Show. It's They're Alive, Damn It! Which is in the theme song from The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which is kind of hilarious and kind of weird, and it's been stuck in my head. Like, I keep wanting to just shriek They're Alive, Damn It! At inappropriate times, so I'm hoping that this will get out of my head after I listen to it a few times.
Hopefully it's available.
The Musical Obsessions playlist.
You can try Teen Titans for real.
That'll work. Do you have a regular obsession?
Me? Yes. I have lots. Okay, can
you
want to share
with us?
This is the part where I rewrite the rules and I do tell you several. Yes.
That's fine.
Yes, I don't follow rules particularly well.
Excellent.
One of them is this brownie recipe that I found that has a peanut butter cream cheese swirl in it.
Okay.
And I particularly like that the recipe instructions have you make your favorite brownie mix from a box and then do this swirl thing.
Okay. That sounds like the best recipe ever.
It pretty much is. And the reason for that, I know how to make brownies from scratch and I can do it and it's not hard.
I do too, but I prefer them from a box.
I like them from a box. Also, really, I really like the recipe tweaking process, and so I like knowing that I can just sort of sub in whatever, and that's, you know, good with this recipe author. So I'll send you that recipe.
Oh, good. We will put it in our show notes, which, as always, are going to be exhaustive.
Yes, and I have to interject right now that Kelly and I talk every week, and easily a quarter of our talk each week is given over to recipe sharing.
I don't actually like to cook all that often, but I like to think about cooking a lot. But I did actually make these, and they were really good.
Yes, Kelly is the source of a previous obsession on an old episode of the podcast when I was talking about tater tot casserole.
Oh, yes.
Which we had for dinner tonight.
Yes, which I learned about tater tot hot dish, which is basically a casserole, as I understand it, from the author Caroline Stiebemer, who's a friend of mine.
Oh, Caroline.
Yes, she's lovely, and she knows her way around a tater tot hot dish.
Good for her. Well, and I am grateful to her and to you. So you have other obsessions?
I do. So I have read pretty much all of Stephanie Burgess's middle grade work, but I had not read her adult work. And The Art of Deception, which is a novella she did, is awesome. It is about a swordsman and an innkeeper with magical training who go to the White Library, which is full of political intrigue of the very dangerous kind, which is in some ways matches my concepts of libraries, even though I really love them a whole lot. and it was very wonderful. So I have to read all of her adult stuff now, so that's wonderful.
Well, Anna can endorse Mask of Shadows.
Masks and Shadows, yep. I think I purchased the one that you're talking about. I haven't read it yet.
Maybe, oh my gosh, it's a novella, so it's quick.
It'll kick me into gear.
Yes. Also, did either of you read The Dark Days Club?
Yes.
Anna did. Yes.
Okay. That was fun. I love Alison Goodman.
I haven't read the next one, have you?
I have not read the next one. I don't get to read nearly as much as I would like because it starts to feel like too many stories in my head when I'm writing.
Yeah.
But I really enjoy it when I can. And I really liked with that one. So it's about it's basically a Regency demon hunter in which the sorts of situations that you might find yourself in as a female Regency demon hunter have actual consequences. And so you can't just go do whatever you want. They have social consequences and they have danger consequences and everything else. And I found that really interesting.
It was interesting. I'm not sure I like the love triangle situation that was developing. So that's why I wanted to know if you read the next one. I predict that you'll read it before I get the chance because potential love triangles will keep me away until I have a report on what happens.
Okay, I'm making my list of spoilers to tell everything.
Thanks.
Whether I will remember or not, who knows, but I will try. Yes.
Anything else?
I think that might be, I already told you about Sorcerer to the Crown, which I love. That might be good for now.
I think I recommended that to you on a previous podcast.
You probably did. That makes me think about, you read me a description of a gentleman character from the Goblin Emperor.
Moon.
The Goblin Moon.
Oh, yes. And Brenna really likes that one.
Does she?
It's a similar situation to the Scarlet Pimpernel, where he's very...
Yeah.
Effeminate almost, and patched and powdered and perfumed, and yet ruthlessly efficient.
Yes, so that I thought of that. What's your obsession, Anna?
So I'm gonna bring the book that I'm currently reading again.
which is a trend.
Which is gonna be published in July. It is by Carrie Vaughn, and it's called Bannerless. It is a post-apocalyptic United States in which there has been what is referred to as the fall, and most of technology has been lost, and there are small communities up and down the West Coast in this case, like it seems to be set in California, and you cannot have children until you earn a banner that proves that you can take care of the child that you're going to have.
Is it a rainbow banner?
It is not a rainbow banner.
Okay.
And so the main character is this woman who is an investigator, and her job is to, like, look at people who might be violating the rules. And the society cares a lot about rules because they believe that, like, everyone doing what they wanted led to the destruction of life as it was known. And so it's kind of a murder mystery, and it's kind of an examination of this theoretical life after an apocalyptic event in our country. So it's pretty cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Nice.
I only read funny books. Is it a funny post-apocalyptic?
Not really.
Okay. Sorry.
Sorry. Pass for
but
you.
But awesome for everybody who's really excited about it.
So I am obsessed with a new comic from Boom Studios called Misfit City. It is four young women and a dog on an adventure in a small town in the Pacific Northwest. There are aspects of it that are an homage to the movie Goonies, and there are aspects of it that are drawn from my own childhood because it was written by a dear lifelong friend and her partner.
Yes.
So, we got issue one today. It just came out yesterday, and we read it, and we love it. It is setting the scene for some grand adventures, and we cannot wait for the next issues to be coming our way. We added it to our pull list, and you should add it to yours at your local comic book store.
Yeah, you should. Yeah. Along with a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I hit the wrong button.
I think that we may have made it to the end once again. Congratulations, everyone.
Way to go, us. Now I just have the Kimmy Schmidt theme song stuck in my head, so thanks for that.
The what?
The Kimmy Schmidt theme song.
You're welcome. They're alive, damn it.
Thanks for listening. You can find us on Twitter at Bellwether Friends, BellwetherFrnds. You can find us on Facebook. We occasionally tumble. We are everywhere, buying clothes.
Mostly. And Chucks.
And Chucks. You can look us up on iTunes and leave us a review, if you want. I'm Anna, and you can find me online at Helga Grace, HelgaGrace.
And I'm Aline, and you can find me on Twitter at Surly Spice, SurlySpice. Kelly, tell our listeners where they can find you.
Hi, I'm Curiosity Jones, pretty much everywhere, including curiosityjones.net, which is my website. And that's a long thing to spell. Here we go. CuriositjoNes. And I almost spelled Teen Titans because that's part of the theme song, but I didn't.
Good job.
And I'm on Twitter, Instagram, all of that.
Yeah, and I will put Reptilian, which is Kelly's jewelry line, in the show notes because I consider it to be beautiful.
Thank you. That's my secret identity, yes.
Yes, very secret, except it's not secret because I'm talking about it all the time.
And you'll be demoing things shortly as we do our various conference rounds.
Yep, we've got a couple of conferences coming up, so you can check my ears for Reptilian Works.
Cool.
So, thanks for listening, everyone.
Our in-and-out music was provided by the lovely Julie Jurgens. You can find her on Twitter at HiMissJulie, HiMissJulie.
Bye. Bye.